You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on member-supported KAXE, KBXE, a local independent national public radio affiliate. That's John Bauer. I'm Heidi Holton. When you tune in to KAXE, KBXE, you hear about arts and nature. You get connected to northern Minnesota. Dudley Edmondson is a perfect guest for us. He is a photographer and filmmaker from Duluth. His career spans nearly three decades. His work has been featured in galleries in nearly 100 publications around the world, from state-specific flora and fauna field guides by author Stan Tequila to Bird, the Definitive Visual Guide. He's also the author of the groundbreaking book, The Black and Brown Faces in America's Wild Places, profiling African Americans in non-traditional vocations and avocations in the outdoors. He's also working hard to make sure that young people have opportunities as well. Dudley, thanks so much for being on with us today.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
You are welcome. So I want to know, when did you fall in love with nature in your life?
Well, I mean, I was a really small kid, probably, I don't know, probably elementary school. I'm originally from Columbus, Ohio, and, you know, we used to do family picnics on weekends a lot of times. We'd go to a reservoir north of Columbus, and I found myself poking around in the woods quite a bit there, near the picnic grounds, and sort of really got connected to that sort of peace and tranquility that a lot of people associate with nature and being in the outdoors.
So when did you decide you wanted to start photographing this stuff and capturing it forever?
Well, that was once I got into bird watching in high school. My art teacher got us into, he was a bird watcher, really sort of a global bird watcher, and he talked about it a lot of times in class. And so he formed a bird watching club with some of his art students. And once I got into bird watching, I got into photography because I wanted to take pictures of the birds I was seeing. And just beautiful birds, you want to take photographs of them. And so I kind of got into photography through bird watching.
What makes a good bird photo?
Well, you know, it kind of depends on what you're going to do with the photo. But I like to, whenever possible, include a bird's habitat in the photo so you get some context of, you know, the bird and just, you know, what type of habitat it likes, forest or meadow or whatever. That kind of thing. Also, I think some action, the bird doing something other than sitting on a branch, if it's in flight or it's calling or it's feeding its young, I think those kinds of things are things that are difficult to capture. And I think that if you're lucky enough to get that on film or whatever, I think that's what makes a good photo to me anyway.
I think one of your characteristics must be patience, because I got to believe you got to be patient to be a nature photographer.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a huge part of the whole job. And I think I've told people what I've done is, to me, you do all the research. You figure out, well, okay, I want to photograph this particular species. You find out what type of habitat it lives in, what it eats, where it nests, and you line all these things up using reference material and just experience of seeing the thing, and then you put yourself in a position to where if you get all of these things lined up and you're lucky enough to find this area and you know there's a bird there but it's not there, you just wait, because you say, at least in my mind, I say everything is perfect. I'm here. I know this is where the bird's going to be. I'm in the right habitat. I'm in the right time of year. So it's like I'm 95% there. I just have to wait. And if that wait takes 4 hours, then it takes 4 hours. But I'm that close. So just sit tight and wait. And I've waited sometimes for days and many hours. And when it happens, it's magic.
And
so,
And that's why you are not a nature photographer, John. Yeah. You would never have that patience.
Sit there and wait for it.
We're talking with Dudley Edmondson today. He's a nature photographer and a filmmaker and author, and he does so much more, getting kids involved in nature. I first saw you, heard about you last fall, because I look at Grist online, and they had a feature on you about being a nature photographer, getting a more diverse group of young people involved in nature, and how you've had these experiences where white people are surprised that people who are not white are in nature. And I wonder if you could talk about that experience a little bit that they profiled there.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm old enough to have had a lot of those experiences. Some people tell me I don't look my age, but I'm going on 60 years of age, and I spent a lot of time in the outdoors over many decades, and have seen or had those kinds of situations where I'm in a space and people are surprised to find me there. People ask me what I'm doing. Sometimes the times that are really odd to me is if I have a pair of binoculars around my neck and I'm in a very birdy area. People have asked me what I'm doing, or if I have $15,000 worth of photography equipment in my hand on a tripod, people have asked me what I'm doing. And I think they're just surprised that even though I have all the identifiers of a person who's a nature lover, the fact that my skin is not white, that's the thing that hangs them up. And so it's just an odd thing. And people oftentimes ask me where I'm from. They don't expect me to be from, maybe even the neighborhood or community they live in, which oftentimes is predominantly white. And so, it's just an odd thing. But my philosophy is I belong wherever I am. So if I'm in a space, then obviously I belong there. And it's kind of one of those things that has driven me because of the things that I do and the kinds of things that I like, I oftentimes find myself the only black or brown person in a space, but I don't let that deter me from doing the thing that I came to do. I might, want to go see a rare butterfly in this space in, some place that's in rural America. And sometimes, you just have to be there you definitely have to be there to see it. And I don't let, things in my head deter me from going and doing the things that I want to do.
Can you tell us a little bit about the book that you did and how it maybe didn't start as a big deal, but it is really, what is the phrase people say? Grown legs? I don't know. A lot of people are using it, The Black and Brown Faces in America's Wild Places. Tell us what the book's about and then what it's been like since it's been out.
Well, the idea was to create a set of outdoor role models for African Americans and show them that, people who look like them are very much a part of the out-of-doors. From one of the people I interviewed was the Assistant Secretary of the Interior under the Bush administration, George W. administration. And, he was African American. He was running, 600 million acres of public land at that time, our national parks, forests, and things like that. So, the idea was just to try to show people to show African Americans people who look like them who were passionate about nature and the outdoors. And, it originally for me it began as a way, a sort of soul searching kind of a thing, because I, just felt like maybe I'm the only black person who really is into nature and has been for my entire adult life. And, so it was just me kind of looking for more people like me. And, over the course of 4 years, I found a lot of people. And then through, going on doing speaking engagements and book signings and things, I've had people, black people, come up to me and say, I thought I was the only person, And so it's like, it was very but you know, it was sort of liberating for me and for those people to understand that nature and the environment is not just something that only white people are into. And I mean, I'm oftentimes trying to also go way back and find other examples of African Americans in the outdoors, people that not everybody's heard of, people like James P. Beckwith, who was a frontiersman in the West. Bass Reeves, who they say is actually the Wide Earp. The story of Wide Earp is actually based on the life of Bass Reeves, who was a black sheriff or lawman way back when. I mean, even people like Harriet Tubman. I mean, all these people had a connection to the outdoors, to nature, doing the things that they did. Trying to think, Matthew Henson, the black explorer, with the poles and everything like that. And so just trying to show these examples, I think once African Americans started moving to urban spaces, looking for life with dignity, in those great migrations out of the Deep South, a lot of black folks lost their connection to the outdoors because of all the negative things that were attached to it in the South, slavery, picking cotton, and even just general, just racism, lynchings, murders, things like that, things that happened to black folks when they were apart from, their kind, so to speak. When you're in a remote area, these kinds of things potentially could happen to you. So I think a lot of folks really sort of lost that connection to nature because there wasn't really a whole lot of positivity connected to it. And then so, once you move to Chicago, New York, the East Coast or whatever, you kind of leave those things behind. But I like to remind folks that we do have a connection to nature in the outdoors. It goes way back.
So, Dudley, speaking of your connection with nature, we do a lot of we have a phenology show, and we cover a lot of things with nature. Are there any observations about birds that you're concerned about, birds that you're not seeing as often?
Well, I would say winter finches are birds that used to be very reliable in the winter, things like red poles and pine siskins and crossbills and things like that. Even in grosbeaks in particular, their populations have really, dropped immensely. And, I don't see those birds in the winter like I used to at my bird feeders here at the house in Duluth, where in the winter I would get, maybe 100 red poles that would, hang out, over the winter, and I would run out of thistle, halfway through the week or so. And now I don't get anything like that. I don't get those large numbers of wintering birds. Even in the spring, the bird song just doesn't seem to be, like it used to be. And, I'm not entirely sure all the reasons behind it, but I'm sure that people are somehow involved in it.
Yeah.
So, definitely changes in numbers.
We heard on Tuesday, we were talking about this very thing, about how the thistle that John Latimer puts out is just not being eaten the way it used to, and not seeing finches and all of that. Now, I'm imagining, Dudley, your backyard. Do you have lots of bird feeders?
Well, yeah, I have what I consider to be the standard fare of stuff. I've got a couple of seed feeders, a couple of thistle feeders, and a couple of suet feeders, and then I keep a bird bath going. And then, strangely enough, sometimes this may be controversial, but sometimes I will, if there's a roadkill somewhere near my house, of a squirrel or a rabbit, I will put that out there too for crows and also a neighborhood fox. So they come in and they feed, and to me they're birds, and that's what they eat. They're not gonna. I do have crows a lot of times will try to steal my suet feeders. So that's another reason why I put out, if I find a roadkill somewhere near the house, I'll just lay it on a snow pile in the backyard near the feeders, and they come in and they feed. Unless, of course, in the middle of the night, the fox comes through and he steals the carcass and it's all over. So,
well, listen, this doesn't sound strange to me because I have a deer carcass hanging outside my kitchen window, and I love watching the woodpeckers and everything that's coming in up close and personal. You know, it starts to look pretty grungy about this time, but that's okay. There's still a lot on there for them to eat. Hey, I wonder if you'd tell us a little bit about what your the fellowship that you have and how you're trying to get young people into nature. Tell us about it.
Well, you know, I didn't, at least, you know, I don't know a lot about fellowships, and I'm assuming they're oftentimes established by other people and organizations. So I have very limited knowledge of, you know, the fellowship, so to speak. The YMCA of Seattle, Washington established it in my name. And they did so because I volunteered. I'd go out in the summers many years in a row, and I would go out and volunteer, and we'd do backcountry wilderness camping with youth from the Seattle area. Originally it started, I went out and gave a presentation, and one of the people who attended it was someone associated with YMCA, and he asked me if I would come back as a volunteer and take kids out of doors and teach them about nature, some of the things that I knew. And so I did that many years in a row. It was always fun to get out there, and we'd go to Olympic National Park and North Cascades National Park, and we just would take kids out for 7 or 10 days backpacking and things. And so after I did that for a number of years, he decided that, as a way to sort of thank me for my time and to get more people of color into environmental education programs, they would establish a fellowship in my name. And so that's kind of what it is. It's a stipend for youth of color to pursue careers in environmental education and the outdoors in general. And so it's been a great honor to have that title. And I've gone out with some of the fellows and visited and talked with them and stuff. And it's kind of weird to have that, you know, these people, Dudley Evanson fellows, and you're talking to them. It kind of freaked me out in the beginning a little bit. Because I never, you know, think of myself in that regard as someone extra special. I'm just me. I enjoy nature and the outdoors, and I just happen to be African American. So, but I mean, it's important for them to see me and talk to me and understand that, you know, I can do this too. I can, you know, I can be an advocate for nature and be African American or person of color, and I can teach about the environment. And, you know, teach other people about nature and things like that. So it's, you know, in many ways, I'm serving as that role model that I try to create with my books and serving in that capacity through the fellowship.
Well, and how cool is it? I mean, usually that kind of thing happens after someone passes away, and you're still with us, and the kids get to see you. So, that's great. You're alive.
It was funny when I sat and talked with them once, and I said, I bet you were expecting some old white guy or a dead guy. And we all laughed. And like, no, but it's just me. And, you know, and so we sat and we had lunch and we went for a hike and we talked and things like that. And it was, you know, it's not common to meet the person that the fellowship that you have is named after. So We had a little fun with that.
So we know you love nature. How do you feel about this storm coming in?
As long as my snowblower starts first or second pull, I'm good.
Okay.
You know, and I've got it. I've got the plugs and the oil changed in it, and it's running great. So I do need to run and go get some gas, though.
Yes.
But I'm ready.
Okay.
I'm ready.
It's photographer, filmmaker, and author Dudley Evanson. You can find more information at DudleyEvanson.com. Thanks so much. It was great to talk to you.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. You guys have a great day.
You too. It's a Friday morning show connecting you to arts and nature. Coming up at 8:40, we're going to find out about a historic opera house in Staples.